This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
15%, a low if appropriate tip at a restaurant, and a low if legal amount to pay the IRS. Mitt Romney and his taxes on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 24th of January. Good to have you with us. The rest of us have a good 2.5 months till tax time. For Mitt Romney, though, it came last night. The Republican presidential hopeful did what you can only call a midnight data dump. He gave his 2010 and 2011 returns to a couple of media organizations, and then the candidate held a conference call about it this morning. The details you probably heard, $45 million or so in income the past 2 years, taxed at something less than 15%. The U.S. tax code being a cumbersome beast, we've called an expert for help in figuring out what all the numbers really amount to. Tiffany Couch is a forensic accountant up in Portland, Oregon. Tiffany, nice to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you.
So, Mr. Romney and this 13.9% effective tax rate that we've been reading about all day, what exactly does that mean?
That is a simple tax calculation where you take the total amount of tax Mr. Romney paid, and you divide that by the total income that he earned.
Simple math, right? Simple math.
It's simple math. In 2011, he earned approximately $20 million. He paid a total amount of tax of approximately $3 million. When you divide that $3 million by the $20 million, you get an effective tax rate for 2011 of about 15%.
Okay, but I thought we had what we call a marginal tax rate system in this country. That is, you have tiers, and then the more you make, the more you pay on that extra money.
That's correct. We do. We have tax tables. If you look at the back of the booklet you get with your 1040 form, there are all those tax brackets that you see. If you make a certain amount of money, you have a certain amount of tax that you pay, and the more that you make, the more that you have to pay into the IRS.
Okay, but what happened here? Because Mitt Romney is like off the tax tables. He's way up there.
Yes, he's way up there. But if you actually look at the types of income that he earned, it mostly came from capital gains, interest and dividend income, and all of that is taxed at a much lower or a capital gains rate for about 15%.
All of this, though, we should point out, is entirely legal. I mean, he got some good accountants and said, listen, help me do what I got to do.
Well, you know, it's a couple of things. If he's used his money to earn money and invest that money, that is a great tax strategy. And not only is he growing his money, obviously, because he had gains, but his tax on those gains is much lower than had he earned that in wages.
These, though, everything we've been talking about, Tiffany, are federal tax rates, right? What are we missing here? There's state, there's local, there's Social Security, there's payroll taxes. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that we're not seeing in this Romney story today.
Well, sure. It becomes quite complicated. So if you
tax codes complicated?
Oh, you know, maybe just slightly. There's state taxes. There are local taxes. We haven't even talked about Social Security and the payroll types of taxes. So there are lots of other taxes that Mr. Romney may be paying that we aren't privy to or really isn't part of this equation today.
Tiffany Couch, a forensic accountant at the Acuity Group in Portland, Oregon. Tiffany, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So here's the thing about that 15% rate that Mitt Romney paid last year. While the news of the day has centered around how he got it, that is by earning investment income, not salary, there's more to it than just that, because he's not the only one out there who pays that low rate, and he's not the only one who's going to pay more if it's raised. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look now at the tax code law of unintended consequences.
A certain Beach Boys song has been running through my head ever since I got this assignment, so let's just get this over with.
It's the little old lady from Pasadena.
I'm supposed to look at who besides Romney would be affected if the tax rate on investments, the capital gains rate, was raised. Yes, little old ladies from Pasadena or wherever would pay more on their profits from stocks or dividends. Sorry, Beach Boys. You don't pay capital gains on retirement accounts, like your 401k. But think about the small nest eggs of little old ladies. Martin Sullivan is an economist at Tax Analysts.
They may be earning $30,000 or $40,000 a year of investment income. And that puts them well above average, but you would hardly say they're living high on the hog.
And yet they would be paying the higher capital gains rate, right along with Romney. Ronald Posner is a CPA with CBIZ. He says the little old ladies should remember that the capital gains rate was 20% for years, before it was lowered to 15% in 2003.
I mean, if it was raised 5%, I don't think it would be a big hardship to them.
But there's one tax Romney pays that the little old ladies don't have to worry about, the carried interest tax. It's a 15% tax on the consulting fees charged by partners at private equity firms, like Romney's Bain Capital. That's usually their main source of income, but they still pay only 15% on it. That's one rate that could be raised without hurting the middle class. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, so let's see. Away from the Sturm und Drang over the many hundreds of pages of Mitt Romney's 1040 form, there were some other things going on today. The Federal Reserve met. That's one of them. It's a two-day session, so news on what they said is going to have to wait until tomorrow. Also, that Greek debt deal we thought was done last week? Oh, no. On Wall Street today, meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We all now know more about Mitt Romney's tax rates than we ever thought we would. And we've been reminded about the difference between effective tax rates and marginal tax rates, always handy. But so what? I mean, does the whole brouhaha over who's paying how much in taxes really matter anyway? What do Americans really think?
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
We talk to Frank Newport every week. He's the editor-in-chief of Gallup for a segment we called Attitude Check. Today, obviously, Mr. Romney. Frank, good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
So you guys were out in the field in the last week or two asking Americans how they feel about the rich and whether they should be paying more in taxes. What do we know?
Well, what we know is what we just found, actually, Monday night, 63% of Americans say yes, they favor a proposal to increase taxes on higher-income Americans, and that's not a new finding. We're replicating what we and many other people have found consistently, that no matter how you phrase it, 250,000, 500,000 or more, a million or more, over 6 out of 10, sometimes two-thirds of Americans say yes. And, of course, President Obama's well aware of those data.
Well, let's frame it as not just 250,000 or more, but say 20 million or more, given Mr. Romney's situation. How much more, then, do Americans think the rich ought to be paying?
Well, we just asked Americans, kind of turned them into accountants, the question, how much do you think that the wealthiest Americans should be paying? And drumroll, the answer was 24%. I think Romney paid 14%, so you do the math, and he's 10 percentage points lower than where the average American thinks he should be as a wealthy, tax-paying American.
Let me ask you a methodology question. Was it open-ended? Give me a percentage that you think the rich ought to be paying, or did you give them multiple choice?
Total open end. We just said to the average respondent on the phone, give us a percent, and our coders typed it in, and we did the average. I should say about 3 out of 10 Americans couldn't answer the question.
Yeah.
You know, they scratched their heads, particularly less well-educated and older Americans didn't really have some conception at all. But when we put the numbers together of those that did give an average, it was 24%.
On that 24% number, though, the arithmetic mean that they came up with, is that everybody ought to pay 24% or just people who have a lot of money?
Just people who have a lot of money. The way we phrase it is the top 1%, and then we even use the word wealthiest, the wealthiest Americans, and that's where we got the 24%.
What do you know about what Americans think about the tax code? I mean, my guess is they don't like it, but do they understand that what happened just, for instance, with Mr. Romney, but with many rich Americans, is the way the law is written?
I think they do. I think the average American is very much in favor of changing the tax code in general for many different reasons, efficiency, and also because they think, as we talked about, that it does favor the rich. So you've put your finger on what I think is a key political question out of all of this. Will Americans simply say that Romney, the man, was taking advantage of a system, and it's the system that needs to be changed, and not blaming Romney at all, or will Romney himself get the blame? And that's what we're going to have to wait and see.
That's why they hold the elections. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do with them every week is called Attitude Check. There's more and the data as well on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Gallup gets its data by randomly but in a statistically acceptable way, dialing people up and asking them questions. We did something a little bit different this morning. We went out with a microphone and asked around.
It is pretty ridiculous how much money he made.
He pays 13% tax, and I pay 25% for taxes, and I can barely afford the place where I live.
I kind of agree with the super rich that have been asking to tax themselves.
He makes a lot of money, and some people might think that 14% is not enough, but he does give a lot to charity, so.
Phil Kim, Pablo Velasquez, Joshua Spencer, and Rick Reynoso, all within about 10 blocks of Marketplace World headquarters in L.A. this morning. Listeners of a certain background might have heard the phrase a New York minute before. How fast somebody can get something done. Do it in a New York minute. Herewith, though, a suggestion for a new time reference to add to the popular lexicon. How about a YouTube second? The popular website for all things video has announced its latest figures for how much material is being uploaded. YouTube is now taking in, get this, 1 hour of video every second of the day. An hour every second. A resounding success for its basic premise, but even with that, parent company Google is still struggling to make YouTube pay. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Think of it this way. If you set out to watch every single video posted to YouTube just in the past week and a half, it would take you 100 years. You heard that right. Matt McLernan is a spokesman for YouTube.
A century of video is uploaded every 10 days.
Pretty amazing for a website that was built on convincing people they should post all those home videos of their singing dogs.
Happy birthday to you.
The reason for YouTube's explosive growth is its move to add more professional content to the mix. Shows like Ellen DeGeneres are posting clips all the time, up to the minute.
The president is giving his annual State of the Union address, and I'm sure mostly he's going to talk about politics. Boring.
The Ellen clips appear on a full-page channel listing, which can be sponsored by TV shows, movie companies, car makers. Ford is using its site to post self-help videos.
Let's talk about some common problems and how to solve them. Give these tips a try while you're parked in your driveway.
And these days, YouTube's McLernan says it's not far-fetched to imagine someone watching while parked in their driveway.
We're seeing a lot of growth with YouTube on mobile. There's so many different devices now, 350 million devices that you can see YouTube on.
Even though YouTube figures people watch 4 billion videos every day, it's been introducing ads slowly to avoid a backlash from viewers. So far, it says it's making money on just 3 billion videos a week, only a tiny fraction of its viewership. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The first big golf tournament of the PGA season is underway down in San Diego, and a big golfing outfitter, the company Callaway, has some new ads on display down there. They are masterminded by none other than Justin Timberlake. Yeah, apparently JT can sing, dance, act, direct, and golf. But can he sell the clubs? Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
So the new Callaway golf ads are not a remix of this.
I'm bringing sexy back.
With Justin Timberlake twirling a 5-iron in a dance club. Timberlake's role is more impresario, mixing with the pros who already sell Callaway. An online video shows him swinging a new driver.
I'm sorry, but that's just sexy.
Timberlake's only played golf about 8 years, but he's a solid 6 handicap with his own PGA tournament in Vegas. Vegas is where the new Callaway ads are set. It's Timberlake's concept. Pro golf icons tee off the rooftops of famous hotels. Morningstar analyst Pete Wahlstrom says other celebrity fanboys have represented sports.
The one that really comes to mind would be Spike Lee with Nike.
Do you know how I get up for my game?
Do you know? That's right. Air Jordan, Air Jordan.
Wahlstrom says MTV did it for years with its series called Rockin' Jock. Sports economist Dan Rasher says golf needs some kind of boost. Playing is down 30% since the recession, and 20-somethings are not buying clubs the way they did when Tiger Woods first hit big.
Because he was young, and he was dominant, and he was fiery, and so he created a huge fan base really fast.
Dominant, fiery, huge fan base, those certainly apply to Justin Timberlake. And with no young, hot American golf star on the scene, why not pick a star who happens to love golf?
So turn around and I'll pick up the slack. Yeah.
I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
I don't know, Justin Timberlake and golf. Anyway, coming up, the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street.
I think that sparked the imagination of people on the left and younger people in the United States of we could do something besides conventional politics.
But first, let's do the numbers. Mixed earnings and an impasse on Greek debt put a damper on the markets today. The Dow Industrials gave back 33 points, about a quarter percent, closed at 12,675. The NASDAQ inched up 2 points, a tenth percent, finished at 2,786. The S&P 500 down a point, a tenth percent, closed at 1,314. Earnings were the domestic story today. Apple's earnings way exceeded estimates. That sent its shares into the stratosphere, up more than 8% in trading after the bell. McDonald's, that normally dependable blue chip, beat profit forecasts, but investors sent the stock down 2.2% anyway on concerns about rising food costs. Verizon rang up profits that fell short of expectations. Its shares fell 1.5%. That dragged AT&T down 1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.06%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors releases its latest pending home sales index. President Obama embarks on a 5-state tour across the country. He'll be in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and then Phoenix, Arizona. And the World Economic Forum annual meeting begins in Davos, Switzerland. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel gives the opening address. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Taxes, the economy, jobs, inequality. Without having actually seen a copy of the speech itself, that's still a pretty good guess as to what's going to be in the backbone of the president's State of the Union tonight. Back in September, when Mr. Obama gave what was billed as his big speech back then to get jobs back on track, we invited some people to come watch with us around our conference table. And then we went into the studio to talk about it, a little debrief about what they'd heard and what they thought things would be like in the coming year. One of our guests that night was 41-year-old Jay Damian. Here's part of what she said back then.
I think things are just going to get worse and more people are going to become unemployed. But when is it going to stop? And I don't think it's going to stop anytime soon. I feel that we're looking at another 4, 5, maybe 6 years before things really start to turn around.
So the other day we got her back in the studio and asked her if she still feels the same way.
Absolutely. I don't see anything getting better. I mean, they say the numbers for unemployment are dropping, but that only accounts for the number of people that are currently eligible for unemployment. And I still know plenty of people that are unemployed and searching.
Tell me about yourself. What are you doing?
I am working part-time, which is not what I wanted to do because, like I told you before, I'm looking for something full-time.
Sure.
But I went ahead and took something part-time, one, just to have something current on my resume, and two, it was just getting to the point that sitting at home searching for work was becoming too depressing on a regular basis.
How long has it been since you've been without full-time work?
Probably almost close to a year and a half now.
And remind us what you were doing.
I have my background's in education and nonprofits.
And what are you doing now part-time?
Administrative work, which is also consisting of marketing, billing, collections, and the automotive field.
Automotive, not education. So
not
you're,
education.
You're way out there.
Exactly.
But you had to have something.
I had to have something. And, you know, I got this on a fluke, and it was because I knew someone who needed someone.
Are you still sending out resumes and you know, doing all that stuff that job seekers have to do?
Well, I stopped for a minute only because I had been told that I was overeducated, I was overqualified, I didn't have anything current on my resume. So I said, okay, I'll take a step back, I'll wait a couple of months, update my resume, and then start resending it out. And I think it's going to be really interesting if I actually get calls because I have something current.
And how many were you sending out, say, on a weekly basis?
At least 100.
100 a week?
At least 100.
Any nibbles?
I was lucky if I got a thank you, but no thank you.
What happens if you don't find full-time work in, say, the next 12 months?
I will have to move in with someone else.
And you've done that already. You're not a college kid anymore. And,
exactly.
Yeah.
I'm too old to go home.
Well, I wasn't going to say that. What do you want to hear from the president when he gives his speech?
I want to hear some concrete change. I want to hear a plan because I still don't feel that I really heard a plan the last time he made a speech.
So
and
what?
I have seen no change.
Do you actually believe it's going to be different this time, that he's going to give you a speech that tells you what you want to hear?
Not at all. I'm not confident with it at all.
You seem not positive, but not as far down in the dumps as I think I would be if I were in your situation.
I think I've had time to learn to contain it.
Yeah.
But it's there.
Jay Damian, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We're going to talk to Jay again tomorrow to see if she heard those concrete things she wanted to hear. The first organized protests in Cairo, in Tahrir Square, what would eventually become Egypt's Arab Spring, started a year ago tomorrow. Egyptians took to the streets by the hundreds of thousands, inspired by the overthrow of the dictator in Tunisia, right next door. We're going to start a series of stories tomorrow about Egypt's post-revolutionary economy, called One Year On. But the protests didn't end in Egypt, of course. They spread to Libya, Bahrain, Syria, and Israel, to Asia and Europe, and eventually here, with Occupy Wall Street. And on the face of it, a lot of those protests look the same. Take over a public square, set up tents, refuse to leave, demand change. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, who was in Cairo a year ago, to explore whether their Arab Spring became our Occupy.
Just after the Egyptians had their revolution, I made my way through Cairo along streets that were still littered with paving stones. They were the stones that protesters had pried up from Tahrir Square and thrown at police in the final battles before Mubarak fell. Marches and demos were popping up everywhere. Half a million people in the square demanding free elections, and small groups on street corners. I met Maged Ghoreb holding a picket sign outside a big Cairo newspaper. 32 with a university education, Ghoreb had been at the paper for 6 years, but he was still considered a temp and was making less than $200 a month, not enough to get married or set up on his own. Ghoreb complained that in Egypt, you can't get ahead in life without connections.
He said the daughter of the editor-in-chief, his daughter just got employed here after 2 months when she's graduated from her university. Why they don't treat us like they treat their own sons or daughter?
Ghoreb had helped overthrow a dictator. Now he was demanding a real job and a raise. Fast forward 9 months. To an Occupy protest in downtown Portland, Oregon. Max Miller and Brian Shaler are in their early 20s. They're trying to finish college and find jobs in media or in the music industry. When Occupy set up tents and started marching, they joined right away.
I mean, it's a matter of numbers. There are more of us that are impoverished than there are people with all of the money.
The problem is that all these college grads are getting out of school and realizing that they've been saddled with like $100,000+ of debt, and they spend the next 4 decades of their lives paying off debt. Like, the disappearing middle class is a real thing.
Young people feeling squeezed, demanding better opportunities and a fair deal. The issues sound similar from Maged in Cairo to Max and Brian in Portland. But in the end, these movements are worlds apart, says UC Irvine sociologist David Meyer.
Arab Spring was about regime change. The Occupy movement includes some people who want regime change and want to rebuild the world from the ground up, but it includes other people who have a concern about inequality that believe that you could have substantial positive change without burning the Constitution. So there are big differences.
Still, occupiers tell me it was watching the Arab rebellions on YouTube that got them off their couches and computers and into the streets. Some Occupy organizers, meanwhile, were watching a rebellion closer to home.
The debate over state budget deficits has led to chaos in Wisconsin, with protesters hanging over balconies in the state house and lawmakers.
A few weeks after the Egyptian Revolution, thousands of public employees and their supporters had massed in the Wisconsin Capitol. They were trying to block Republican Governor Scott Walker from taking away union benefits and collective bargaining rights. The governor got his bill in the end, but David Meyer says the occupation provided a powerful example.
People camped out in the cold, marched through the streets, and I think that sparked the imagination of people on the left and younger people in the United States of we could do something besides conventional politics.
And by September, unconventional Occupy was everywhere. The colorful tent camps, the rowdy demonstrations, and messy mic check democracy. The occupiers took their lead from the Arab uprisings. They borrowed tactics from Tahrir and the labor organizers in Madison. And they managed to launch an unexpected uprising in America to demand economic justice and restore middle-class prosperity. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On our website, there's a timeline of the past year in global economic protests and Mitchell's Reporter's Notebook, protests in Israel that didn't get a whole lot of press. It's all online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, for which I can claim the teeniest possible personal responsibility because I bought my wife an iPhone for Christmas. So too did a whole lot of other people, apparently for themselves, not the misses. Apple reported fourth quarter profits today, $13 billion. I'm going to let that sink in for just a minute. $13 billion in profit. It's the most ever, near as we can tell, for an American company. It was the first quarter, obviously, without Steve Jobs around. And that's Marketplace from APM on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow gave back 33 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ inched up 2 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 slipped 1 point, 0.1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. It's produced by Rada B. Tomorrow on the morning show, Stephen Beard in Cairo. And coming up next time back here, we start our series, 1 year on the Egyptian economy after Mubarak.
Everything is not stable. People, they don't spend as much. So we are not really in a very good state, really, in business.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.